The time is now 6 p.m. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, March the 20th, 2024. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. In tonight's news, a new report from Wisconsin Policy Forum paints a bleak picture of the state's housing market.
Starting in April, a new month-long exhibit will be on display at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
A Dane County supervisor is vying to retain her seat in the upcoming election.
And in the second half, insight from a local middle school teacher, some headlines from 57 years ago, and we're going from spring back into winter. I'll have all the details. Good evening. This is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. And here are the day's headlines.
United States Senator Tammy Baldwin has joined 18 other Senate Democrats in the push for a non-militarized Palestinian state, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They've made the request via letter to President Joe Biden as his administration faces increased criticism over its failure to effect a ceasefire. The letter says, quote, "It is our firm belief that only with two states for two peoples, an independent Israel alongside an independent Palestinian state, will we see enduring peace in the region and safety and security for Israelis and Palestinians alike," unquote. The letter went on to say, quote, "We recognize that none of this is possible until there is a ceasefire in Gaza, all hostages are released, and unfettered humanitarian aid is allowed into Gaza," unquote.
This afternoon, a former Milwaukee election official was found guilty of one felony and three misdemeanor counts of election misconduct, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. In 2022, Kimberly Zapata ordered three absentee ballots under fake names and sent them to the home of State Representative Janelle Branchon. Neither side in the case has disputed these facts, but Zapata's attorneys argued that she was a whistleblower, namely that she never expected Representative Branchon to actually fill out and cast the ballots, but was actually trying to draw attention to the fact that there was a flaw in the election system. They also argued that she was at home, Zapata was, when she ordered the ballots and therefore not acting as an official in an official capacity. Prosecutors countered that Zapata, Milwaukee's former election commission deputy director, committed fraud in the election system she had sworn to protect. After 5 hours of deliberation, a jury ultimately sided with the prosecution. They found Zapata guilty of misconduct in public office, a felony, and three misdemeanor counts of making a false statement to obtain an absentee ballot. Her sentencing is scheduled for May 2nd.
After months of saying Donald Trump could not defeat President Joe Biden in this year's election, State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss now endorses Trump for president. Voss once called Trump's candidacy a, quote, "suicide mission," unquote, and has said repeatedly that Trump would not be able to beat Biden in 2024. Trump is now considered the presumptive GOP candidate for president. On Tuesday, Voss changed his tune and now says that Trump could win election in 2024, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Voss has also said that if Trump did win the nomination, he would possibly vote for him, reports CBS News. Voss and Trump had had a contentious relationship over the years. Trump pressured Voss to overturn the election results in Wisconsin in 2020 after Trump lost to Biden in the state by a margin of 20,000 votes. Voss did authorize spending taxpayer money to fund an investigation of the 2020 election results, but no evidence of fraud was found. The lead investigator of the effort was subsequently fired. And in 2022, Trump went so far as to endorse and fund Adam Steen's primary campaign against Voss, but Voss narrowly defeated Steen.
Governor Evers signed two bills into law today that seek to bolster the state's vehicle infrastructure, electric vehicle infrastructure. The first allows private businesses with EV chargers to sell electricity by the kilowatt hour. In doing so, it fulfills a federal requirement, thus bringing in up to $78 million in federal funding. And the second bill establishes a program to dispense that federal funding. Businesses looking to construct charging stations in the next 5 years can apply for grant money from the state, covering up to 80% of installation costs. Both bills had bipartisan support, as well as support from businesses and environmental lobbyists.
The Common Council has agreed to a $3.7 million land purchase deal with Viridian Homes. That money will purchase 55 acres of farmland and expand Elver Park. The land acquisition also complements Viridian Homes' existing plans to build 600 apartments and homes along the park. Already Madison's largest park, Elver Park's size will now reach the Ice Age Trail, according to Eric Knepp, Madison Park Superintendent. While the city faces a $27 million deficit in 2025, Knepp says the money for the land purchase comes from funds that have already been collected from developments, according to the Wisconsin Journal-Sentinel. Elver Park already offers ice skating, trails, cross-country skiing, disc golf, and a host of athletic fields and courts. Over the next year or so, the Parks Division will create a master plan for the use of the additional park grounds. New athletic fields and dog parks are in the mix for future plans, reports the Wisconsin State Journal.
And as you may know, a cicadapocalypse may be looming for us this coming spring. More than a trillion of not one, but two different cicada broods will be surfacing across several states in May, including here in Wisconsin. This would be the largest hatch of cicadas since the early 19th century, and it's thanks to the emergence of one brood that rises from the earth every 13 years and another that comes up every 17 years. The second is the one that we're most familiar with here in Wisconsin. While there are also cicadas that appear annually, of course, these periodical cicadas live most of their lives beneath the earth's surface. And the rise of the periodical cicadas is expected to start in May and last for several weeks, but they won't stay terribly long. The males of the species die soon after mating, while the females die soon after laying their eggs. And those are the evening's headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories.
Whether you own your home, rent, or are unhoused, finding a place to live could be the central crisis facing Madison. And these challenges are likely to be more severe in the years ahead. City planners say we could gain 115,000 more residents by 2050. New research released today from the Wisconsin Policy Forum finds that the housing market for Dane County is particularly bleak. WORT news producer Faye Parks has the details.
Over the last 5 years in Wisconsin, both housing prices and the average household income have gone up significantly. But a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, a nonprofit research organization, finds that income hasn't kept up with housing. Mark Sommerhauser is the forum's communications director.
The median sales price of homes in Wisconsin increased by more than 50%, 53% in just 5 years. In 2017, it was about $173,000, all the way up to $265,000 in 2022. Incomes did increase significantly in that period, but not nearly enough to keep pace, about 19.7%.
Their report also assesses the numbers county by county, and six of them stood out as having a particularly wide gap between their average household income and average home price. According to Sommerhauser, those numbers can be misleading, as most of those six counties have smaller populations and more recreational and vacation properties. But that is not the case in Dane County, the sixth in that list.
You know, I think that's really an indicator that Dane County is one of the places in Wisconsin, and perhaps the place in Wisconsin, where housing is least affordable when we look at it relative to people's household incomes.
For Wisconsin renters, household income has more or less kept pace with the price of rent during the same period. But Sommerhauser says that because rental markets are highly localized, those statewide numbers might not reflect Madison's unique circumstances. The report, released today, analyzes the most recently available data. With any analysis, these findings might change in the future.
We have reviewed some somewhat less reliable data that is more recent than that, that does suggest that, you know, perhaps there's been more significant increases in rental costs here in Wisconsin in 2023. But we're going to need a little bit of time for that to kind of shake out so we can eventually get our hands on some more reliable data.
So what's causing housing prices to skyrocket? The report, in part, points to the increased demand for housing during the pandemic, when more people nationwide were looking to buy their first home or buy bigger homes for lockdown. But according to Sommerhauser, that is just one contributor.
I think that, you know, there also is an issue specific to Dane County where you have just population growth, right? There's more and more people moving into Dane County. That's increasing the demand for housing. On the supply side of this equation, there's been a lot of data to show that we really have not kept pace. We just have not built enough new housing units to match the increase in households.
Statewide, the number of households in Wisconsin has increased by more than 211,000 since 2010, even as fewer than 145,000 housing units have been permitted. That leaves a deficit of nearly 67,000, which can also squeeze prices up. And new housing can be expensive to build, especially given inflationary costs for building after the lockdown. Sommerhauser says, while state and local governments can do little to address that, there are still opportunities for municipalities to promote affordable housing.
Zoning changes that allow for, you know, things like smaller homes on smaller lots, permitting more development of what planners and urbanists refer to as the missing middle types of housing units like duplexes and triplexes and townhomes and things that, you know, changing zoning codes to make it easier to build that kind of housing could help, I think, to produce, you know, a broader spectrum of options in the housing market and just to produce more housing units overall, both of which I think would definitely be beneficial.
Already, between 2010 and 2020, Madison added about 36,000 new residents. And under the city's comprehensive plan, it's expected to add 70,000 more by 2040. In the past few years, the city of Madison's made multiple changes to its zoning laws to account for a rapidly growing city. Things like loosening rules for accessible dwelling units, allowing more unrelated renters to live together, allowing more housing density along bus rapid transit lines, and most recently, an attempt at what's termed proactive zoning. On a state level, the Republican-held legislature and Governor Evers passed a package of bills to promote affordable housing across the state in a recent legislative session. But Sommerhauser says the state still has more tools in their toolbox.
Whether it's funding for affordable housing programs that are administered at the state level, or whether it's programs that are more aimed at providing resources for municipalities to be able to facilitate more housing construction.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
When it comes to the Vietnam anti-war movement, folks tend to regard the protests on college campuses as the primary point of resistance. But many men and women who served in the armed forces were also part of that movement, and their efforts are often overlooked. Starting on April 2nd, the Wisconsin Historical Society is hosting a month-long exhibit featuring movies, discussion, and music about the active soldiers and veterans who opposed the war. Our reporter David Ahrens has more.
I sat down with Norm Stockwell, the publisher of the Progressive magazine and one of the organizers of Waging Peace in Vietnam, an exhibit and program starting April 2nd at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
It really showcases the U.S. soldiers, uniformed soldiers within the military who were opposing the war. And one of the things, as you look at the history of the anti-war demonstrations in the United States beginning in about 1965 and moving forward, more and more either uniformed military or recent veterans would become part of and the leadership of those marches and demonstrations. And that's a little known piece of history. Actually, most people think of the peace movement here in the United States as being, you know, students on college campuses. Mm-hmm. So you'll see in this exhibit GIs who were imprisoned, GIs who took great risks. Susan Schnall, who's speaking on the first panel, was a Navy lieutenant who led soldiers and sailors in a demonstration in San Francisco. Ron Haberly, who was a photographer at the My Lai massacre, he was an Army photographer on duty. On Wednesday, April 10th, the screening of the film Sir, No Sir, by David Zeiger. It's a wonderful film that chronicles the growth of this opposition to the war within the U.S. military with lots of historical footage. The very important story that comes out of this exhibit is when people realize what's going on, what's being done in their name by their government, and they see the civilian casualties, the destruction of homes, the displacement of people, that's when the people in the military stand up and say, this is not me, not in my name. But the story of the GIs within the military making that personal transformation and then using their power to push for an end to that war is what you see in this exhibit, Waging Peace in Vietnam, during the month of April.
Waging Peace in Vietnam is sponsored by the Wisconsin Historical Society, UW academic departments, and many community organizations. The first program, Soldiers in Revolt, will be on Tuesday, April 2nd at 5 p.m. It will feature Ron Habel, who took the first photos of the My Lai massacre, and Susan Schnell, a Navy lieutenant who was court-martialed for leading a demonstration of soldiers and sailors. This is David Ahrens for WORT News.
In less than 2 weeks, Dane County voters will decide who sits on the county board. District 28 represents Cross Plains, Mazomanie, and the surrounding area. And two candidates are vying for the seat, incumbent Supervisor Michelle Doolin and challenger Bill Brocious. Earlier this week, Supervisor Doolin spoke to WORT News producer Faye Parks to discuss her priorities for the district.
Thank you for joining me, Michelle.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So to start, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Born and raised in Wisconsin. That's not so unusual. I'm the mother of three. I'm also a grandma, and I spent 35 years as a hairdresser and worked in every aspect of the field. And then I became disabled. I was diagnosed in 2016 with multiple sclerosis, which it is Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month. So, you know, that's significant to me. And so I had to shift things around. I went into education for a while and hairdressing and then administration until the pandemic. Now I shifted into the licensing part of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protections. So I'm pretty resilient. I wasn't done with life. I still have plenty to give. So I wanted to do something that utilized my skills. Having been a licensee in the state of Wisconsin, I get to help other people in different trades and in the agriculture business as well get their license as well. So that's been kind of fun.
And what are some of your accomplishments since being elected to the county board?
I'm running for my third term on the Dane County Board. I was raised to know that democracy was this very important thing. I am a first-generation Democrat, so I guess there's that, but I'm still the woman my mom raised me to be, that you know, you vote in every election and you participate in your democracy because that's the only way that democracy thrives, and that's the way your government has your voice if you voice it. And that brought me to, you know, 2016, 2017, the political climate wasn't so great. I ran for the Dane County Board of Supervisors because I feel like government should be, you know, it's for the people, by the people, a diverse group, different backgrounds, different talents, different voices, but everyday people should be part of that. And so that's why I ran. In my time on the county board, in my first term, it was cool because one of the things I felt was really important, because my district is 28, so it's rural northwestern Dane County. And at the time I first ran, there was a bit of a resentment at the divide in how things worked. It appears from out here that the county board caters to Madison, and then everybody else is a bedroom community, or, you know, we get whatever's left over. And I didn't figure that was entirely true, just that perhaps people didn't understand the difference between how county services and how needs are met in a, you know, rural as opposed to an urban or suburban setting. When you are urban, there's more than one way to fulfill certain needs. As imperfect as they are, there's usually more than one option. There are multiple entities that serve similar purposes. In a rural setting, you have one or two entities that serve multiple purposes. For example, Northwest Dane County Senior Services, our senior center here in Cross Plains. It is also a thrift store. It also is a community gathering room. And that's the only senior center that I know of in the entire district, serving 11 different municipalities between villages and townships. So I wanted to bring that voice to the board. When I was appointed to the City County Homeless Issues Committee, one of the things that somebody brought up, it was somebody from the public schools. They're talking about how, you know, doubled up homelessness, especially during the pandemic, that had been brought to the forefront because they don't meet the HUD housing categories that make you eligible for services unless you're technically homeless. So people who are doubled up, that's the face of rural homelessness. And it's not exclusive to Roldan County. So I thought this would be a great way, you know, to find advocacy and to create a position with some of our ARPA funds. That was the first draft resolution I ever did. And I didn't realize it at the time, but first I was told it wasn't going to pass. And it passed cleanly through both committees before the board and passed unanimously on the board. But the excellent part about that is it was the first of its kind in the country to do that. And that's something that this term we've grown. We had that pilot project position with ARPA funding, but then we are starting to expand that. Now that we have some data about the need, we're using that data to expand it further and actually, you know, advocate for people that fall between the cracks in services. And that's really been a lot of my goal and my accomplishments, is just to make sure that people don't fall through the cracks if we can help it. Because Dane County has a wealth of services, but not everybody knows how to access them.
Is there any work that you've started that you'd like to continue, either for the county or for District 28 specifically, if you're reelected in April?
One of the things that I had to help push through was the regional housing strategy in the budget on the planning and development side that's meant to address the supply issue with affordable housing. And that's just getting off the ground. So the idea was, you know, we're just getting to the point where we want to start implementing that. Because with the multiple municipalities, we can't just, you know, help everybody, but we want to help position all the individual municipalities to be able to access grant monies as they come down so that they can develop affordable housing plans for their communities that are unique to their communities, but also have support for that. And I'm really kind of hoping to work with that if I'm reelected.
And so with the Dane County executive race around the corner, what are your thoughts on that? And if reelected to the county board, how do you plan to handle that transition?
I'm hoping that we find somebody that, you know, fosters unity between communities with varying needs and backgrounds, you know, in both rural and urban settings. And I would really like somebody who is focused on making all of the departments in Dane County places everybody wants to work. You know, there's been a little bit of discord, and I really want to make sure that we have effective government. The board makes the policies, but it's really the people that work in the various departments that go to work and make those work. So really want to cultivate that. And also, you know, that separate but equal branches of government, you know, the board, we are a three branch system in Dane County. And I want to see a lot more, you know, coexistence between all three branches so that we can make policy decisions and implement them and work the people in a more equitable and unifying and friendly way.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes, everybody, please vote on April 2nd. It's really important to exercise democracy. If we ignore it, it'll go away. So please, please vote. Your voice is so important. Please reach out if you need assistance in knowing how to vote or where to vote. Voting is the most important thing.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Michelle.
Thank you very much.
That was incumbent supervisor Michelle Doolin, one of two candidates vying for the District 28 seat on the Dane County Board. District 28 represents Cross Plains, Mazomanie, and the surrounding area. Doolin says if she retains her seat, she will continue to advocate for the county's rural communities. We'll hear from her challenger, Bill Brocious, later this week. Doolin and Brocious will face off on April 2nd.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on community radio station WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for staying with us.
On this week's episode of Madison's Backbone, feature contributor Riley Cutright sits down with Irene, a middle school world history teacher. Irene offers valuable insight about the expectations of a school teacher, some complex lessons, and a relentless enthusiasm for providing a public education every student deserves.
A community is a unified body of individuals sharing something in common. Over a quarter of a million people call Madison, Wisconsin their home. Have you ever wondered about the secret to Madison's vibrant and unique community? Well, I have the answer for you. Workers. This segment features the working voices who undeniably strengthen and brighten Madison's community on the daily. I am Riley Cutright, and this is Madison's Backbone. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Madison's Backbone. I'm here with Irene.
So I am an eighth grade social studies teacher in the suburbs of Madison. I teach a world studies class, which means like we teach about kind of what's going on in the world, like recent-ish. It's technically a geography class, but we teach it as geography and current events and history that we need to know then. Yes, it's an ambitious goal in one school year. We try to teach a little bit about every pocket of the world.
How did you get your start as a teacher?
So as a classroom teacher in Wisconsin in particular, it was an incredibly wonderfully windy road to that. I went to ed school like in the early 2000s to be a high school German teacher, and I have never been a high school German teacher. I wound up not being a teacher right after college and instead working for a Holocaust survivor. And that kind of changed my path to wanting to teach about history, the history of the Holocaust and World War II in particular, and then it grew into history writ large. And then I worked in a museum after that, and then I worked as a social studies teacher abroad, and kind of all these experiences like coalesced into realizing like the happiest place I was professionally was always in a classroom. And I think teenagers are fantastic. And so life brought me to Wisconsin that way.
So what does a work day as a teacher usually look like for you?
It looks like a beautiful concert of chaos every day. It is full and it is intense and it is wonderful and exhausting. I'm someone who tends to get to school like before our contract time because I like to ease into my day, knowing the day is just going to be so vibrant and busy. Officially, our day starts like around 8 a.m. Students start to come into the school and then we have something called advisory, which is like a homeroom time with about 16 students. So we see those 16 students at the start of every day. And that's where like school announcements happen. Like we kind of check in with them. Those are families we're kind of in communication with the most because I teach about 130 students. Sometimes like we're playing games together to build community. Other times we might be doing learning kind of around significant cultural events that are happening. After that, my day is filled with social studies. So I have four of my five classes right in a row. And then the three periods at the end of the day are for like teacher prep and meetings. And then we all have like a supervision assignment at our school. And I'm super lucky that mine is with a seventh grade social studies teacher. So I get to help support her fabulous classroom. And then it's like winding down for 10 minutes and remembering I still have some coffee in my to-go mug and then thinking like, what do I need to do before the next day? Officially, it's 7:45 to 3:45. But for me, it's usually about like 6:45 to like if I'm kind of in the zone or if I need to take care, prepare a lot to 4:45. I try and really not go beyond that. I know so many teachers put in hours upon hours, like inside and outside of contract time to do things. And that's kind of my way to help both preserve my time and like preserve my joy in teaching too.
So you said that you went to Boston University to get an education degree. Is that like a four-year degree? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I actually technically have a BA in German language and literature because I had hoped to be a German teacher. Instead of being a double major, I did like an education certificate. So I did all of the like teacher training work, but I don't technically have a degree in education. And then I have a master's degree in Holocaust education. So I had worked for a Holocaust survivor. I had worked in a Holocaust museum as well, instead of being a classroom teacher right out of my ed program. And kind of my master's work came out of that. And that's a master's degree that was an individualized study program. So I got to take some education classes, some museum studies classes, and some history classes. And then I also have a PhD.
And what?
Yes. So my students call me doctor, which is delightful and meaningful because I'm very proud of it, but also a little funny when you hear hundreds of 13-year-old say doc. Very humbling in the best way. But I have my PhD in curriculum and instruction with a focus on social studies education. So I've also worked in teacher education, like training people how to be elementary school teachers and social studies teachers. And it's pretty rare to have a PhD and be a public school teacher. Sometimes people who have PhDs either in fields of education or in particular content areas tend to go to private schools. But I have to say, I'm really proud to be able to show my students that I had the incredible privilege to be in school for a long time, that I recognize that as a privilege, that I had the space to think a lot and learn a lot, and that I believe that learning and that thinking is meaningful towards how I could support them. Even when I had planned to be a high school German teacher, I always wanted to be a teacher in a public school space. I deeply believe public education is a necessary and important and vital service. I believe everyone has the right to a strong and meaningful education. And for me, I was in academia for a long time. It took me a long time to get my PhD. And while I absolutely loved the privilege to think and learn, I was noticing the place I was happiest was when I was in classrooms, like observing my student teachers, and or when I was in classrooms connecting with teachers for some of my own work.
What is the most difficult part about your job?
The most difficult part of my job, I would say, is how much is expected of us as teachers, I think, even beyond what any of us might felt we were training or hoping to become, right? I am expected to be intellectual support, right? You know, my job is to bring those ideas to students and then for us to kind of learn together and grapple with big questions and like see where that curiosity could take us. So I'm expected to come to that being some level of expert in content. And I'm also expected to be in a role of emotional support and understanding the emotional needs of the 25 people in front of me. And I'm expected to collaborate with my colleagues to be able to make all of this meaningful. And all of that is wonderful and necessary with this wonderfully bizarre experiment that is public education and all of us learning in the space together. But that's a lot for a single human. And while I'm fortunate to be in a really supportive school with really supportive leadership and a fabulous team, that feels overwhelming when what prepared us for this work, at least formally, was like learning history, learning pedagogy. And here we are learning together how to take care of each other in this space. Another part that's difficult is navigating different people's expectations around what a teacher should do or what schools should do. Teachers come to this work with their own individual values that I hope, at least for me, are informed and impacted by the people in front of me. But then there's also like society's expectations of us as well. There's a district expectations. And when that clashes, usually the person, I would argue, who feels that the most is teachers.
What is your favorite part about your job?
This might come as a surprise to people who might not spend a lot of time with middle schoolers, but my favorite part is spending time with middle schoolers. Like, they're hilarious. Are you kidding me? Like, it is like the most awkward time in like any human's life. Like, your body is changing. You're navigating like friends and relationships, and you want to be treated like an adult, but then someone gives you a little bit of adult responsibility and then you act like a kid again. Like, it's so messy. And I love that because I think they still bring, like, middle schoolers bring this amazing combination of silly and serious, which is so my vibe as a teacher. Like, I am a teacher who advocates fiercely for teaching about complex histories in complex ways. I think when we do that, students rise to the bar we set for them. But like, then they'll also like be goofy with you talking about like the most ridiculous stuff. And they know how to navigate both of those things like with respect and fun and care. And like, I get to spend my day with like weird and smart and interesting humans. And that is so genuinely exciting and so wonderfully challenging. Like, no day looks the same. And I love that. Like, for me, like, I appreciate the routine of a school day, but I love even within the same day, right? The lesson I teach to my first hour group, it's going to be the same lesson, right? The same sequence of questions, the same sequence of curriculum. But how my first hour takes it up and my fifth hour takes it up is so wildly different because of the perspective of the students. And that's so fun.
Thanks for tuning in this week to Madison's Backbone. I'll be back in 2 weeks for part two with Irene of what it's like being a middle school teacher.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather guru, Rob McClure.
Well, after a couple of modestly colder than normal days on Sunday and Monday, those were our first two of the month, by the way, we spiked back to 56 degrees yesterday, I guess to celebrate the last day of winter. Of course, as the vernal equinox actually approached late last evening, the temperatures started dropping to more winter-like levels, with Arctic air then pouring into the area on brisk northwesterly winds to kick off this first full day of spring. We were 24 degrees colder today than yesterday. And in keeping with that theme, we're now going to set up for what looks to be perhaps a pretty good snow. Indeed, perhaps the best snow we've seen in more than 2 months. The last time we saw more than 2 inches of snow, in fact, at least 2 inches in one day, was back on the 12th of January. And the current prediction out of the National Weather Service Sullivan office is for 5.5 inches overnight tomorrow into Friday. That's a fair bit more than I was expecting when I gave the forecast back on Monday, but looking at the forecast model trends recently, and especially the few rounds of high-resolution modeling that have now started to come in, a total like that does appear possible. For what it's worth, if it's any consolation, the follow-on storm, which will be Sunday into Monday, or perhaps even Monday into Tuesday, is looking a fair bit warmer and less snowy than it did. In any case, if you have a look at the water vapor image of North America that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, you might note first how Wisconsin goes from upper troughing to upper ridging to upper troughing again all over the course of the three-day loop there back to Monday. That's a kind of graphic display of our jumps up and down in temperature through that same period. Look out to the west, though, off the coast of southern Oregon, and you'll see out there a couple of leftward spinning gyres, almost side by side, actually, at the moment. The less organized looking one, which is nearer the coast, is going to quickly eject eastward over the mountains tonight and get strengthened and drawn our way by a speed maximum in the jet stream that's diving southeastward out of northwestern Canada, down and around the upper trough that's in place over the Hudson's Bay region. That interaction is going to help deepen the surface, a surface low over Nebraska late tomorrow, which will be traveling east-southeastward from there through Iowa and Illinois as we go into Friday morning, with a substantial elevated warm frontal boundary sloping northward up over top of us here during that time frame. Lift over that boundary is going to produce a kind of general snow as we get past midnight tomorrow, and an elevated portion of the circulation, about a mile above ground level, will likely then produce some banded precipitation in narrow regions anyway, which will be hard to pin down, but I suspect that that would be where any possible 5-inch amounts of snow might end up. This is going to be a fast-moving system on top of other complicating factors like warm ground and a temperature profile, especially in the southern tier of Wisconsin counties, which may be turning the precipitation over to either sleet or rain. So a really difficult storm to forecast with any degree of specificity in terms of snow amounts and locations. And it is also unhelpful that the high-res models are producing variously from 1/2 inch up to 10 inches across southern Wisconsin. That's not much of a range to have to try to choose from. I'm going to, again, hedge towards the lower totals on this, by and large, I guess. 2 to 3 inches, I think, in most places, given the warm ground and the short duration. But snow rates could be pretty intense for a time early Friday morning, even whitening up the pavement substantially and slickening them up, so that might be a concern for rush hour that morning. We'll clear and cool then from Friday through Saturday, with Sunday also now looking dry, given steady model delays in the ingress of this second storm, which will be the stronger of the two. That one is now looking more rainy rather than snowy, but I wouldn't want to hazard a guess as to what the models may yet do with it over this coming weekend. But back to the forecast for just a few more details. Tonight, passing high clouds will gradually thicken up as temperatures drop towards about 20 on northerly winds at 3 to 7 miles per hour. Tomorrow, passing high and mid-level clouds may be joined by lower clouds as we get later in the day, and temperatures will return to the mid-30s, perhaps the upper 30s, on veering east to southeast winds, generally light before they begin to strengthen more as we get into the overnight period. And strengthen they will, up to about 10 to 15 miles per hour during the overnight, holding temperatures up around 30. Snow should start to work into the area from the west towards midnight, with a fairly steady and perhaps heavy round of snow then for about, say, 4 to 5, maybe 6 hours as we go into the day Friday. Southern areas especially may get mixed precipitation with this and therefore less accumulation, but I'm expecting 2 to 3 inches most places, with a couple heavier west-east bands turning up. Snow should end by the mid to late morning hours with lifting and some breaking of the skies by evening with a high temperature in the mid-30s and banking northeast to north winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Temperatures will drop into the teens with clearing as we go into Saturday. And Saturday should be mostly sunny with a high temperature in the low 30s on northerly winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour, veering more northeasterly later on. And high and mid-level clouds then may increase as we go overnight, and we should be back, I think, towards 40 on an increasingly windy Sunday as the next storm starts to approach us. At the moment, at the station down here on Bedford Street, the temperature is 34 degrees. The dew point is a very dry 2 degrees. Winds are out of the northwest, 10 miles per hour, still gusting up towards 20 with some regularity. Skies are almost entirely clear, just a few strands of cirrus passing overhead. And the barometer's at 30.12 inches of mercury and rising slowly.
We go now to March 1967, as the campus and city and campus bubble with artistic and political ferment. Stu Levitan has the news from 57 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s. All these come on. They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, March 1967. When University Avenue expanded in November 1966 to four lanes heading west and a bus lane heading east, campus leaders warned of a likely tragedy. It finally happens on March 1st, as campus beauty queen Donna Shuler walks into the side of a bus and is injured so badly her left leg has to be amputated. Students, faculty, administration, and regents renew their plea with the city to move the bus to Johnson Street, but the city refuses. On the 2nd, the Wisconsin Student Association Senate votes 19-11 to ban the Madison chapter of Students for a Democrat Society from campus until at least next fall as punishment for the role its leaders played in the disruptive protest against the Dow Chemical Company in late February. WSA Senator Paul Soglin, who had joined the peaceful mass occupation of a Bascom Hall hallway in a related protest, argues against the suspension. The ban, which SDS President Hank Haslett calls childish, and the student court quickly overturns, greatly enhances SDS's popularity and expands its unofficial membership to about 300 almost overnight. On the 6th, Chancellor Robin Fleming issues a more meaningful statement, detailing that he will continue to use whatever forces necessary to ensure compliance with the administrative rule against disruptive protests. Fleming gives the document an oratorial flair. Quote, "Given the traditions of this campus, it is fair to assume that the faculty wants to preserve dissent but without anarchy, and that it wants order but without oppression." At a special meeting 2 days later, the faculty rejects 249-62 a motion by sociology professor Maurice Zeitlin to ban interviews by corporations, quote, "involved in producing war materials," and adopts instead a policy allowing any bona fide employer to recruit on campus. Vilas professor of sociology William Sewell is among those voting to ban employers like Dow, which is returning for more interviews in October. Fleming will no longer be chancellor then. On March 28th, after first turning down the top job at the University of Minnesota, he accepts the presidency of the University of Michigan, starting in September. His successor as chancellor is Professor Sewell. According to the results of a WSA referendum on March 21st, students want there to be a draft, they just don't want to be called for it. They vote 5,260 to 3,980 not to abolish the draft, and 4,989 to 3,972 that the university should stop cooperating with the draft by compiling class rankings. On campus, March is a great month for music, theater, and the underground press. From the 3rd to the 7th, the radical literary journal Quixote and the Students for a Democratic Society present the anti-LBJ adaptation of the Macbeth, MacBird, in Ag Hall. It's just days after the world premiere in Greenwich Village, and playwright Barbara Garson makes a special appearance. On the 7th, the first underground newspaper in the state, Connections, is published as Bob Gabriner and Stuart Ewan expand their 1965 counterculture commentary, Act Tracks, into 16 edgy and irreverent pages. It's experimental at all levels, from layout to distribution, and, quote, dedicated to remaining underground rather than being buried above ground. The paper is delayed a day when North Shore Publishers in Milwaukee refuse to print it. The Courier Hub Publishing Company takes the job instead, but insists on blanking out certain words. The editors agree that an expurgated paper is better than having no paper at all. On the 11th, Rhythm and Blues great Smokey Robinson and all the Miracles bring Motown to the Stock Pavilion for Greek Week. On the 17th, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band plays two blistering Union Theater sets, earning cheers from the crowd and a condescending review in the Capital Times. Assembly Speaker Harold Frelick has a low opinion of youth culture. On the 22nd, he calls on the legislature's Joint Finance Committee to cut the UW's budget as punishment for, quote, the moral and social degeneration on the campus. Frelick is especially incensed at the Daily Cardinal's publication of a photo taken inside a bathroom. The biggest entertainment news happens on a rainy Eastern afternoon in the town of Madison, as a crowd of about 4,000 attends the dedication of the Dane County Memorial Coliseum. The March 26 celebration comes barely 4.5 years after Dane County decided to build a sports and entertainment arena. The building is 312 feet around and 98 feet high at its center, with 7,670 permanent seats and 3,330 temporary ones. It was designed by the firm Law Law Potter & Nystrom, whose founding partner, James R. Law, was mayor when the city first considered Frank Lloyd Wright's auditorium and convention center overlooking Lake Monona. Some finishing touches remain, but Coliseum manager Roy Gumto vows everything will be ready for the inaugural event next weekend, the Zohr Shrine Circus. In schoolhouse news, on the 16th, Superintendent Robert Gilberts upholds the decision by La Follette High Principal August Vandermeulen to prevent graduate student Mark Greenside, UW-66, from serving as an unpaid student teacher because he won't shave his goatee. Gilbert says the trim facial hair, quote, would not have a desirable effect on students. Greenside, who must perform student teaching to obtain his license, accepts an offer from the Verona schools. On the 28th, the West Side Vandals strike again, as teen vandals with slingshots and rocks break 21 windows and several reinforced doors at Van High School, causing about $2,000 in damages. It's the 7th such instance at Van High's, Odana, and Orchard Ridge schools since September, accounting for nearly $10,000 in damages. Police nab 5 youngsters who explain they did it, quote, for lack of anything better to do. In Cityside news, on March 23rd, the Common Council lifts parking meter restrictions on Monday and Friday nights, making street parking free after 6 p.m. And on March 24th, as is the long-standing practice, most Madison stores, all banks, and all government offices except the post office are closed from noon to 3 p.m. for Good Friday. But something new this year during services, anti-war demonstrations inside the First Methodist, Covenant Presbyterian, and Bashford Methodist churches. There are no arrests. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported WORT news team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson. Your reporter was David Ahrens. Special thanks to Riley Cutright and Stu Levitan. Katie Giorgella is our on-air engineer. Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.